views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. We are going to talk about war for profit, an inside look at the military-industrial complex. We are going to talk with Mr. Hartung, William Hartung. He has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many other publications. He has also written the book Profits of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and How Much Are You Making on the War, Daddy? He also appeared in several documentaries on this. And we are going to talk about the where the money is behind the military-industrial complex, who's getting the money, how much is going towards the military. It's not just the Pentagon budget. There's many different areas of the government's budget that actually goes into the military. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about who the biggest players are and how much money is being spent into the black budget. It's hard to know because it's black, but we're going to dive into those and see what's going on there and what we can do to rein in the spending. I mean, we all want a strong national defense, right? I mean, we need that. We need to protect ourselves as a country. But do we need the many, many bases that we have all over the world? I actually think we spend more on international funding or spending on the military all over the world than we do on national defense. National defense is our top priority. But I think we're spending it for different reasons, and people are wondering what's really going on. I think we'd actually be safer if we spent less internationally, and I think that goes without being debated, being honest. I mean, you can debate different specifics of it, but the amount of money you spend on offense instead of defense makes you less safe. And we spend a lot on offense. And offense is something that you need to really question on whether that's the right thing for our country or not. So we are going to talk to William Hartung. And he right now is the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. And he's going to join us to talk about this and give us some insights on where all this money is spent. So let's welcome William Hartung to the program.
Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I want to get right into this. I read a quote, and I think a lot of people have, about Eisenhower, and it's kind of the famous thing that people bring up when they talk about the military-industrial complex. But, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address, January 1961, he warned about an immense military establishment and a large arms industry had emerged as a hidden force in U.S. politics, and that Americans must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. How would you say we're different today from back then? Because my understanding is, I've been doing a lot of research, I was almost overwhelmed with how big we are now. Are we substantially bigger than back then?
Yes. The Pentagon budget is about twice what it was when Eisenhower gave his speech, you know, adjusting for inflation. And we have large companies like Lockheed Martin that themselves get $35 or $40 billion a year from the Pentagon and are larger than the operating budget of the State Department for just one company, and also do a lot of other government contracting intelligence and IRS and census and FBI. So there's kind of these all-purpose government contracting firms that they do surveillance that really didn't exist in that form in Eisenhower's day. So there's more money flowing. The companies are larger, and they have probably more levers of influence than they had then. The one difference is that our economy has grown dramatically. So the Pentagon is not as big a share of the GDP, but it's still a very powerful lobby.
But in today's dollars, where it's about twice the size of the budget.
Yes.
But when I was, you know, doing research on all this stuff, and I have been for a while, the military, the Pentagon is just part of the military now, right? I mean, because there's so many different departments, like, well, the FBI. Is this all considered part of the Pentagon? FBI, the CIA, the NSA, Homeland Security, even NASA gets involved in this stuff. There's 16 different spy agencies. Is that in the government budget, is that considered part of the Pentagon, or is it all a lot of these things not part of the Pentagon budget?
They're almost all separate departments or line items. So the Pentagon gets $500 billion a year for its base budget, $50 billion in addition for its war budget. Then nuclear warheads are at the Department of Energy. You have intelligence, as you said, and Homeland Security. And so if you look at all the other military-related items, including taking care of our vets, it goes to more like $1 trillion. So it's a huge investment in all sorts of military-related activities, only about half of which is located at the Pentagon.
And so when they talk about the Pentagon, you know, they talk about the military budget, do they kind of fudge things by just talking about the Pentagon's budget so it seems like it's a lot smaller?
I think so. Yeah, I think if people knew the full range of military activities, they'd be, you know, holding onto their wallets a bit. They'd be probably shocked to realize how much that is. And a lot of it is things that used to be military functions. I mean, protecting the borders was traditionally the Pentagon, you know, military's job. Now that's Homeland Security.
Well, is that a way to increase the Pentagon's budget in a way? You just start creating all these other agencies that, and you spin it out of the Pentagon, and then so the Pentagon's budget really is bigger because you're taking those kinds of items and putting in these other agencies, and so they don't have to be, from a budget standpoint, they don't have to look like it's part of the Pentagon's budget.
Well, I mean, the Pentagon, you know, it has a little less bureaucratic control over these other departments, but certainly in terms of Eisenhower's description of the military-industrial complex, the same companies contract with Homeland Security, with the intelligence agencies, with the FBI and so forth, as contract with the Pentagon. So on the corporate side, it's a pretty uniform, you know, complex of organizations. And then on the government side, there are some, you know, bureaucratic skirmishes and such. So it's, you know, it's not exactly like the Pentagon controlling all that, but it's certainly all for military purposes.
Well, yeah, maybe not the Pentagon, but the military-industrial complex controls
yes.
it. I mean, the Pentagon's just one part of the military-industrial complex.
That's right.
So they're almost, when you look at it like that, they're almost as large as our, I mean, what percentage of our total budget is the military-industrial complex?
Well, at $1 trillion, it's probably 35 to 40% of the whole budget. And that includes Medicare and Social Security. So it's, you know, it's the entire, federal expenditure. So that's a very substantial amount at a time when we're scraping to invest in infrastructure and reform education, do all the other things that we want to do, pay to clean up environmental disasters. So it really puts a crimp in the rest of the things that we can invest in.
Well, do you think maybe it even could be bigger than that when you start looking at some of the black budget issues? I was reading an article, and this is really known out there, that there was, you know, $1.3 trillion that were missing. Even Donald Rumsfeld was talking about that. And then from HUD, they have, you know, $50 billion a year that is just missing, and they think it's going towards black budget stuff. And so could it be bigger than we realize?
Yes. I mean, there's some discussion whether they you know, the intelligence budget is, you know, sort of hidden in the Pentagon budget, you know, so it fits under that half a trillion, or whether it's completely separate. But the fact is, we don't know. I mean, they have said that all those intelligence agencies together spend about $80 billion. But since they don't release any detailed budget figures, we don't really have a way of checking that.
Well, and every time there's like the HUD, when they're missing fifth, they think that HUD is money is being funneled back into these military things. But every time they go to audit or review numbers, they say that it's unauditable.
Yes. The Pentagon has never passed an audit. And it's not just they audited and there was a few things missing. It's like they can't audit them at all. And it's partly because they have, you know, 22 separate computer systems, most of which don't talk to each other. It's partly just sloppiness. They've had fewer contract officers. They've been cutting back on those, even as Pentagon spending has gone up. So the Pentagon doesn't seem to show a lot of motivation to make their books auditable, because it would make them more accountable. And we'd start asking questions about some of the waste that's, you know, contained in that budget.
Well, from a computer system standpoint, their technology for their own programs is off the chart. We're far superior to every other country in the world. NSA is monitoring everything that we're doing, but yet their own computer systems can't talk to each other, and it's in the dark ages. You know, can't talk. So it's almost a laughable argument that they can't get their act together from a number standpoint, but yet all their other computer systems are great.
Yeah, it's question of priorities. You know, I think there's a disincentive to be more accountable about their budget. I mean, you know, they've got a million civilian employees. They think 700,000 private contractors, although they're not able to do a real count because they can't keep track of them all. So that's a gigantic bureaucracy. I mean, there's many more people in the bureaucracy than there are troops in uniform. So you got that huge overhang. And then the question is, what are all those people doing? You know,
and exactly. Well, how could you possibly have that big of a budget, and what are you doing with it?
And I think, you know, with an audit, maybe it would become clearer that a lot of those functions are not necessary. But then the Pentagon would have less money and therefore less political clout.
Are you familiar with the law that allows the military contractors to be excluded from the SEC accounting rules for public companies?
No, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I was reading I was hoping you could educate us on this, but do you know who Catherine Austin Fitz is?
The name's familiar, but I don't know.
I was watching a conference that she was at, and she was talking about a new law that went into place in the early 2000s where the military contractors are not held up to the same accounting rules as all the other companies in our country by the SEC. And so they're the public military that are on the public stock exchange, they do not have to report. And so they just can falsify financial statements. So that's their way of, we have no idea what we're spending on them either.
So basically, the government side is unaccountable and the corporate side. So it's,
it makes sense. If you're going to make the private side accountable, you could probably backdoor figure out what the government's doing, I guess.
And to a significant extent, yeah.
And so they made it so now both sides are unaccountable. And so they actually made a law that they don't have to report that.
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's unacceptable, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and there was a very interesting, and I want to hear about this, and I know you know a lot about this, how weapons are sold to other countries around the world. I was watching they brought cameras into this convention. They were selling weapons to generals around the world, you know, different military generals and different high-powered military people around the world and, you know, that are part of the different military organizations. And it was like a car convention, except they're selling weapons. You know what I mean? There are booths, and they were showing all these different, you know, tanks and big military items. and they were selling it to generals, and it was very salesy, marketing oriented. And I thought that was very interesting. Have you had an experience of being able to go to any of these conventions or learn about these things?
Yes. I've been to the Paris Air Show, you know, three or four times, which is one of the larger ones. There's one in Dubai, which is, I'm told, even larger, but the setup is normally the same. You've got these booths with people who'll tell you anything you want to know about the weapon, you know, I mean, not top secret things, but they'll sort of give a spiel for why this weapon is, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. They'll have all kinds of handouts. They'll have glossies. They'll have, you know, films of their weapons in action. I was looking at a particular bomb, and I had been trying to figure out who produced it. They had little name tags on the side of, you know, the 10 companies that were involved in producing it. So, you can learn a lot, you know, if people don't know that you're a critic. I mean, you just sort of listen, and there's amazing things happening. They have entertainment chalets where they wine and dine people while they're watching planes do demonstration flights. If they think you're a live customer, they can take you on a test flight. You know, they'll get you with a pilot and they'll take you up in one of the planes. The U.S. actually has a permanent pavilion there. Instead of putting up a new one at the Paris Air Show each time, the building is just sitting there waiting for them to move back in every 2 years. So it's quite a scene. I'm told in Dubai they also do live fire. They blow up tanks and fire missiles into the Gulf. And, you know, I was talking to a publisher who one of the defense publication, and he said, oh yeah, it's so neat what they do there. It's like going to Disney World or something.
So this is crazy.
Yeah. There's just this kind of festive atmosphere that you can almost forget that these things are made to kill people.
Yeah. You're buying things to kill people. And when I was watching a part of the clip of the opening speech that they were giving to the convention and how they must be all prudent in fighting terrorism. And that's a major threat. And we all need to build up our arms so that we can protect ourselves from terrorism. And, you know, this convention was probably about 4 years ago or something, but it was really interesting. And then they also, one of the big companies, and I don't remember which one it was, maybe it was Lockheed Martin or General Dynamics, I can't remember. She was a sales representative for the company, and she would bring these people to, I think this was the one in Dubai. She would bring them to, they have a station where they would show the weapons and stuff. And so, or, you know, like a complex where they would show the weapons. And so they would bring whoever they wanted to, like a customer, like you were saying, to this place, and they would show them the weapons, and they could do live demonstrations and all that stuff for a buying customer. And I just thought that was amazing. How much are we selling to other countries, and are we tracking what, you know, who, what hands these are going into?
Well, in the last 5 years, the Pentagon has a special program where they broker arms deals called foreign military sales. And so that program alone, they made $169 billion in new agreements to sell weapons. A lot of them in the Persian Gulf, huge amounts to Saudi Arabia and the other countries there. And if you look at the current war in Yemen, getting to the issue of where do these weapons end up, the Pentagon and the Yemeni armed forces acknowledge they lost track of $500 million worth of small arms, great, which they believe are either with the Houthi or with Al-Qaeda. Then, Saudi Arabia is using U.S.-supplied weapons now to bomb Yemen with many civilian casualties that have been reported. And then the armed forces of Yemen broke into two factions. So one side is fighting with the Houthis, one side is fighting with the former government. So basically, every combatant or every combatant force in that war apparently has some kind of U.S. weaponry. So there's this whole argument that is made when these things are sold that they're a force for stability in these regions. And, you know, the Yemen case is probably the most extreme example of how it's quite the opposite.
Well, we could feasibly be providing all the weapons in the world almost and providing both sides and just feeding this beast.
Well, there are other countries in the game. I mean, the Russians, probably the biggest mark on their policy is arming the Syrian government. The UK has try to get into the Middle Eastern market. And they had a huge bribery scandal going back a couple decades with British Aerospace, which is now just called BAE, bribing Saudi officials to sell them fighter planes. The French are very aggressive selling because they want to build their own aircraft and their domestic market is small, so they balance it out with foreign sales. So then you have China, which mostly sells small arms, but they can do some of the most damage in some of these civil conflicts. So there's a lot of people in the game, but the U.S. by far sells the largest amount in terms of the money value.
And with 500, would you say 500 million was missing?
Yes.
How could you, I mean, it's just like the $1.3 billion that was missing, part of the, you know, that Donald Rumsfeld was talking about. If they were very serious about making sure it wasn't getting in the hands of other, you know, our enemies, wouldn't you think they'd put a lot more restrictions on that? Or do you think there's an incentive to get it into the hands of the enemies?
I think they're just, you know, they hand it over. And then, you know, they're captured by the other side, or the soldiers, you know, in Iraq for quite a while, the soldiers weren't getting paid. Their higher ups were stealing the money that was supposed to go to pay them. They would sell their weapons to be able to eat. You've got things like in Syria where groups armed by the U.S. decided they would join ISIS because ISIS was winning and they were losing. So there's all kinds of ways that it happens. In Iraq, they sold a bunch of weapons during the height of the war, during the Bush years, without keeping track of serial numbers or exactly how many large quantities that ended up with the resistance to U.S. intervention. So part of it is just once you give them to somebody else, your ability to control it is much reduced. And part of it is they don't seem to really put much attention to that. And I don't know if it's purposeful or just, you know, bad policy, but it certainly happens far too often.
Well, I saw a quote from Colin Powell. He says, I'm having a really hard time justifying the budget because we're running out of enemies. And so, you know, with that in mind, how do you think – I mean, how do they justify all this money that's going towards the military-industrial complex? What's going on? Why are they spending all this money?
Well, there's a couple things. One is the argument that we essentially are the global policemen. We have to be ready to go anywhere at any time to fight on any battlefield. And so that means hundreds of military bases. It means 11 aircraft carrier strike groups. It means hundreds of thousands of troops overseas. So it's sort of like if you accept their premise, which is sort of, you know, if the U.S. wasn't there, all you know, chaos would break out. Then that's one rationale that they have. You know, the others have to do with things like nuclear deterrence, even though we have 5,000 nuclear weapons and about 300 would be more than enough to scare any country from attacking us. And then, you know, they kind of hide the fact of how much goes into the bureaucracy, but that's in terms of actually chewing up money. That's a huge piece of it. You know, it's always about allies. We're doing it for allies. And then the, you know, the current, threats they're pointing to, like ISIS, actually take up a fairly small amount of what they're spending at the moment. They had a little line item for the war on ISIS of $5.3 billion, which for anyone else is a huge amount of money, but for the Pentagon is only 1% of the resources they have available. So they'll point to things. They pointed to Ebola for a while, to ISIS, China, you know, having jousting in the South China Sea over resources with its neighbors, Russia and Ukraine. Many of these things don't directly threaten the United States, or the things we're buying are not relevant to dealing with those conflicts. So they sort of point to threats, but then the things they buy often don't relate to what the threats are, or in many cases, the threats don't really have a military solution in the first place.
Well, so it seems like there's two reasons why we're doing this. One, to keep the military, to keep everybody employed and to keep lining their pockets. And then what do you think about globalization, the fact that corporations are moving into everywhere. Could that be a major reason why our military is moving into everywhere?
Well, I think it's shifting. You know, there was a time when the U.S. military kind of very explicitly served certain corporate interests. So, you know, military and intelligence. So, for example, the installation of the Shah of Iran was because the elected government there wanted to nationalize their oil fields. Or the coup in Guatemala in the 50s was because the government wanted to nationalize lands owned by United Fruit. And, of course, a lot of the Middle Eastern concern has to do with access to oil. And the reason that the United States puts up with so many awful things that the Saudis do is because the Saudis are a big oil producer. So there's that kind of relationship. But then in some cases, the terms of globalization are almost more punishing than the military. I mean, just the terms on which people are able to get loans are used as leverage to have them restructure their economies in ways that don't necessarily serve the population there. And then there's a terrible side effect of globalization, which is it makes it easier to smuggle things like small arms because finance is less accountable. Shipping is less accountable.
Yes.
But sort of the underside of globalization is you can move illicit goods much more easily than perhaps you could in the past.
Well, because the rules aren't as strict there as it is here. So a lot of corporations are realizing that and moving things out. But could that be part of the privatization drive with the military too? Because you can, as long as a private company is overseas, we can do whatever we want because the rules are so much less. Whereas here, we can't do it as much. I mean, you know, there's a drive that way. Does that make sense?
I mean, the one area where I've seen that is in the privatization of waging war. You know, so you had a company like Halliburton, which in Iraq was supposed to be repairing the oil infrastructure and feeding the troops and building military bases and, you know, doing people's laundry and, you know, all range of things. And they're the biggest beneficiary of that war, but they lost track of a couple billion dollars. And it's very hard, you know, when they're that far away for U.S. investigators to keep track of what they're doing. And they argue it's a war zone. We're busy fighting a war and so forth. And when they finally did appoint a inspector general to look at this stuff, he found huge amounts of fraud and shoddy work and so forth. But a lot of the money had already been spent. So essentially he was exposing after the fact these terrible scandals, but it was very difficult
to do anything,
prevent them from happening in the first place. You know?
Well, how much are we just overcharged?
Nobody really knows. I mean, you know, that's part of the audit problem. But, you know, in Iraq, there was a company shipping oil and fuel in, and they were charging, you know, 3-4 times and more what, you know, the normal price would be. And they argued it was for transportation costs because they were, you know, in some cases had to be transported through a war zone. But, you know, there were whistleblowers who demonstrated that they were, you know, at least double charging and maybe more. Halliburton had this thing where they were charging for meals that they were serving, and they charged for many more meals than they actually delivered. And, you know, they said, well, we just sort of count how many people are in the theater, and we assume we're feeding them all. But in some cases, the food was so bad that people were just spending their spare money elsewhere. So, you know, there's all kinds of ways that
weren't they charging just an astronomical fee per meal?
Yes, yes.
And also, it was bad.
and for doing a bag of laundry, you know, pretty much everything was way jacked up. And the argument was always, well, we're operating in a war zone and it costs more. But a lot of that really didn't hold up to scrutiny.
Well, that's kind of like that famous toilet seat thing back in the, I don't know when that happened. I remember the toilet seats that were being like $700 for a toilet seat or something.
Yeah, in the back in the Reagan years.
Yeah.
And things like that still happen because of the way procurement's set up and because of the inability to track the money. And every once in a while one will pop up. But, you know, there's some of us have been considering keeping a running list of examples just to underscore how egregious it is, you know.
Well, yeah, because that's a big part of the budget. So how do they get away with this? I mean, what is the culture that's allowing them to get away with it?
I think part of it is fear. You know, people feel like, well, if there's those threats out there, spending more on the military is better than spending less. And it's sort of, they don't look at the Pentagon as a bureaucracy. They just think about, you know, helping the troops. So there's kind of this almost missing piece of the equation, which is changing a little bit. You have some conservatives who are for capping or reducing the Pentagon budget because they finally accepted the fact that the Pentagon is this huge governmental agency that's just sucking up money for no apparent purpose. But a lot of people don't see it that way. You know, they just see it as every dollar that we throw to the Pentagon is helping the troops. I think, of course, there's the jobs issue that.
Well, we have to, I got to stop on that one. We have to be a little less naive. I mean, it's a, we can't say every dollar is helping the troops because even if that's your goal is to help the troops, you can't be so naive to know that people aren't going to commit fraud and that you still have to run it as a business. I mean, when it's 40% of your budget and we have people here that, I mean, we have major issues, you have to take it pretty seriously. But anyways, keep going.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So the contractors tend to spread the jobs as widely as they can so that members of Congress feel like they can't vote against their systems, even if the systems don't make sense, because they don't want to be accused of undercutting jobs in their state or district. Likewise with military bases. Even the Pentagon admits they probably have 25% more military bases than they could possibly use for any purpose. But Congress won't let them close them because they're employers in important parts of the country. So I think if you're tied into it economically, you're less likely to look at the wasteful aspects because you're afraid, you know, any criticism of the Pentagon could eventually bleed back into undercutting the parts of Pentagon money that comes to your company or your military base or your state. So I think there's this kind of look the other way aspect that has something to do with that. And I think there's some discouragement. People feel like, oh yeah, government wastes money, but you know, what are you going to do? Pentagon wastes money. Every other agency wastes money. We're never going to solve it. And I'm just going to get on with my life. You know, so kind of an apathy or just discouraged aspect that keeps
it's overwhelming.
Yeah. I mean, just the amounts of money are very hard to process.
Well, I could just take a little tiny, tiny piece of that and be happy. I think that's how people think, right? They just want a piece of that pie. And no one's looking anyways, so why not?
Yeah, I'm surprised that there isn't more. I think it's growing. You know, concern about all the waste and bureaucracy and overpaying and so forth. But I think for some people, it's, you know, they're just afraid, as I said, that if the Pentagon becomes delegitimized in some way and not can't be trusted with our money, then some of the things that pay for local jobs will get caught in that process as well and get cut back. And some of them should be, if you strictly go by what we need to defend ourselves and not view the Pentagon as a jobs program.
Well, exactly. And that's kind of what it is in a lot of ways, is to just keep jobs going. And when people legitimately want to cut back on the Pentagon budget, and not just the Pentagon, but the industrial complex budget, what is keeping them from doing that?
Well, there's a lot of campaign contributions to these members, many of whom are already inclined towards the industry because of the jobs in their district. The industry has 1,000 lobbyists, which is, you know, almost two for every member of Congress. They hire people from important positions. You know, the head of acquisition at the Pentagon went to work for Lockheed Martin after he had just approved a big contract for them. And so, you know, it's quite likely when he was negotiating the contract, he was giving them a pretty good deal because he knew he was about to go work for them. And that happens, you know, many of the generals and admirals go to lobby for companies. They don't keep good statistics anymore, but it used to be about 2,000 a year, people coming from either the military or the Pentagon and going to work as executives or lobbyists.
The revolving door.
Yeah, exactly. And so that gives them special leverage because they know the people that they're trying to, you know, get the money from.
So the executives sit in a board meeting and they strategically figure out who we want to get into the Pentagon, how we can keep this revolving door going.
Yes. And it goes both ways because you've got people coming out to work for industry, but also people from industry going to government. So when George W. Bush came in, Lockheed Martin sent about a dozen people into positions like, you know, deputy national security advisor and State Department person for Latin America and head of military satellite procurement in the Air Force and the guy who helped run the nuclear warhead complex at Department of Energy. So if they had any problems with any of those agencies, they had a person that they knew very well who used to work for them that they could work it out with.
You know, you wouldn't be so upset about all this stuff if it wasn't that we were killing people with it and that we were breaking laws overseas and here nationally, and that money is the driver of so much of this. You know, when you look at your national security, it's hard to swallow the fact that money is what's driving so much of this.
Yeah, it's almost like a parallel universe. There's the universe where it's sort of believed that we need all this for defense, and there's the universe where you actually follow the money and you see how much of it is for lobbying, how much of it goes into waste, how much of it forces us to buy weapons that are really not relevant. Because once the system gets going and it's got political momentum, even if they decide, oh, actually, we don't need this thing, it's very hard to stop it.
Well, and there's a culture, too, where if you start, you know, criticizing the Pentagon or the military industrial complex for their waste and things, they accuse you of not supporting the military, which is really two different things, right? I mean, as a business executive, if you're going to criticize waste, that doesn't mean you're not for the business. It means you are for the business. You want it to run better and smoother and be more efficient, and we want our country to be stronger. So criticizing the waste, getting rid of the fraud, making sure our goals are in line with what we're doing is an important part of being, you know, running our country better and making sure that our goals overseas and locally are aligned.
Yeah, it's really a pro-security argument. It's saying if we're going to have this institution that protects us, let's make it run as effectively as possible. And so, yeah, that argument that, you know, taking money away from the Pentagon makes us less safe assumes that the money that's being spent now is making us safer when much of it is not.
Exactly. And it's assumed it's not going in the wrong hands. It's assumed that we're competent at managing the money, which it's proven on multiple occasions that we're not. I mean, there's a lot of issues. Have you seen any of the underground facilities that they're creating all over the country? I know that's kind of in the whole conspiracy world, but there's actually really are films showing all that a lot of money is going towards building underground bases in the United States and elsewhere. Are you aware of any of that stuff?
Other than some of the existing ones, like the ones for controlling the nuclear forces, and you know, there's underground storage of all kinds of things. But yeah, I'm not familiar with, you know, major bases being built underground.
Well, I know there's a major base in Denver under the airport where there's videos that are out there showing the base under the airport. And I was curious as to how much money is going into some of those things, if you knew anything about that.
No. You know, I don't know if it's broken out. I mean, there is a lot reported about the Pentagon. Some of it is kind of hard to dig up. It's in these obscure documents, which aren't very well explained. So it could be that case where it's just sort of buried in a haystack, or it could be that they're not actually reporting that level of detail.
Well, because so much of it is confidential, right? I mean, when they can make almost everything confidential, it's very hard for us to really know what's going on.
Yes. I mean, there's sort of two layers you have to penetrate. One is secrecy, just stamping everything top secret. And then also certain things that the companies do. For example, you know, I was trying to find out where some of the small arms in some of these conflicts were coming from, you know, which companies. And the State Department would say, well, that's confidential business information. You know, because somehow if somebody knows that company A is selling rifles to this conflict, then another company will somehow outbid them and it'll hurt their business interests. Or, I mean, it's absurd, you know, given that there's lives at stake.
Exactly.
controlling these things, that information should be public. But this confidential argument has been around for as long as I've been trying to research this stuff.
Well, and confidentiality is important. Let, you know, don't get us, if you're going to be doing a strategic mission, you can't tell everybody what you're doing. But at the same point, when everything's used to be confidential, then it it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it can become a kind of an umbrella under which a lot of fraud occurs.
Fraud, incompetence, whatever, hiding, whatever. So how do you think that the United States is at home and abroad, and maybe we can, you know, separate into two different conversations here, is being affected by just this mass military industrial complex?
Well, I think at home, it's foreclosing a lot of other options. So investments, you know, Pentagon spending creates fewer jobs than pretty much anything else you can do. 25% less than a tax cut, about 1.5 times less than infrastructure or environmental investments, 2 times as many teachers for the same money. So, you know, we're losing employment and we're losing the ability to solve a lot of domestic problems because, you know, the government only has so much money to invest. I mean, if we wanted to raise taxes and run a huger deficit, there'd be more money, but people don't want to do that. So we have a set amount of money or it's growing at a set rate. And therefore, there's a lot of important public investments that aren't happening. Not to mention we have, you know, unbelievable rates of poverty and underemployment for being the wealthiest country in the world.
So cutting, you said cutting taxes creates 2.5 times as many jobs as spending the money on the military industrial complex?
25% more. So not
25% more. Okay.
But an increment more. And then overseas, in addition to the cost of the troops who are at risk, sometimes in wars like Iraq, which should never have been fought, the United States' reputation in the world is tied very closely to our military presence. And so I think that does not speak well for us. We spend 12 times as much on the Pentagon as we spend on the State Department. And also Robert Gates, when he was Secretary of Defense, pointed out it takes more people to run one aircraft carrier strike force than there are trained diplomats in the entire U.S. State Department.
Yeah.
So it means when there's a problem, our people available to consider diplomatic solutions, who know history, culture, language of the region that we're concerned with, there's few of them to generate.
We're just doing a good job at it, right? I mean, because when we went into Iraq, we did an amazing job going militarily and taking them down. And then we did an awful job afterwards diplomatically and running the what needs to be done and fix, you know, setting things up. And like you said, maybe the diplomatic efforts before war even occurs, we just don't do a good job at the softer aspects of running the country. But we're really good at taking people out with missiles.
That's right. And somehow there's this idea that if you don't use force, you're not doing anything. And in fact, people who call for reducing foreign commitments, foreign military commitments, are accused of being isolationists sometimes. But that doesn't account for the fact that you can have economic relations, you can have diplomatic relations, you can have cultural exchange. There's all kinds of ways to engage the world that aren't military, but they're sort of almost not counted in the equation in some of the debate that we have about what our foreign policy should be. And then the disasters like Iraq, there seems to be a very short memory, at least in the press, of just how dysfunctional that was.
How bad we were at it. I mean, we were just so awful at it. I mean, we were great at going in there and taking them out, and then we were just completely incompetent at the other parts of it.
Yeah, sort of a conventional war where you're taking out tanks and aircraft and bases. U.S. military is the best in the world at that. But if you've got a guerrilla insurgency that you've helped to create, fighting that with high-tech weapons is not necessarily that effective. And then the Pentagon was in charge for a long time of the rebuilding effort. So they're used to, you know, letting companies run rampant with cost overruns and such. And also they just didn't have the expertise to oversee, you know, is they're rebuilding the electrical grid. Are they doing it properly? So the companies, you know, were very free of, they didn't have people overseeing them who knew a lot about the business they're engaged in.
Or the culture of the place that we're in, right? I mean, we didn't have the people who understood the local cultures to make sure that what we do was going to be accepted. And, you know, obviously if you're going to make a change, that the change that you make is going to be hard to be accepted. But we didn't need to make changes that the culture wasn't going to accept. So you do it in a smart way where the culture will be much more accepting of the change. You don't change everything. You change the things that only need to be changed, and you understand the culture.
Well, yes. For example, they had this process called debathification. Anybody who was in
exactly
the death party was let go. Now, a lot of those people were doing it because they had no choice, not because they believed in Saddam Hussein's ideology. And a lot of them were important to keeping the country together. They were engineers. You know, when they were rebuilding the country, there were all kinds of people who knew about the infrastructure who could have helped repairing. And they said, well, no, they're Baathists. They're, you know, we're not going to hire them. And also they let go most of the Iraqi military, including letting them take their weapons with them. And they became the backbone initially of the resistance to the U.S. occupation. So you almost couldn't have done a worse job. And the State Department actually had done all these elaborate plans about what should happen during and after the occupation. And Rumsfeld and his circle said, oh, we don't need that. You know, we're just going to go in.
We're going to save money on that part.
Yeah, we're going to go in. We're going to overthrow the government. Democracy will bloom. Case closed. You know, so they didn't even want a plan for the aftermath. And then, of course, they gave the contracts to all these big companies instead of smaller companies or Iraqis who had local knowledge and could have done it much more efficiently.
So I was watching you on a panel, and it was brought up that our military power is just so immense, and our technology and things, and that the way people in other countries view us is they're just terrified of us and what we're capable of. How would you say that's accurate, or how would you really portray that?
Well, I think, you know, countries that are portrayed as our adversaries, countries like Iran, probably are, you know, very concerned, and I'm sure there's a level of fear. And some of the countries, there's also sort of this level of pride, like we're not going to let you scare us, and we're not going to let you change our direction. But it, you know, both elements exist, and certainly the fact that the United States has fought more wars than any other country since World War II creates a lot of anxiety around the world, and also in many places anti-U.S. sentiment.
Sure, and that's the danger of us being always involved in all these wars, is that it creates almost this allegiance of people wanting to take us down.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we need a total kind of reversal of how we invest in foreign policy. And, you know, there's a lot of, over history, a lot of positive things the United States has done in the world, but they tend to get that vision of the United States gets muddied and overshadowed when so much of your presence is military.
Well, and to be fair, we have done a lot of good things, but lately we've been almost too aggressive and so those people forget what good things we've done if lately we're not doing as many good things. You know, if we're doing the negative is overshadowing some of the good things we've done in the past as well.
Yeah, I fear that's the case. Yeah.
Well, what do we do to get things back into balance? What would, if you had the power to do something, you know, like just take over and you had a magic wand and say, and everybody could listen to you, what could we do? How do we get it back into balance and be healthy?
Well, I think we'd have to weaken the lobby. You know, so there's a movement afoot to try to overturn Citizens United, which lets unlimited money into politics. And that's a hard fight, you know, because they need a constitutional amendment. But it's gaining some momentum, and I think it's got to be on the agenda, because as long as a few people can write big checks and influence entire directions of
ridiculous.
That undermines our democracy, obviously. I think the revolving door should be dealt with. I think one proposal was a strict 5-year limit you have to wait 5 years before you work for industry, which would mean at least your Rolodex wasn't quite as warm and you'd possibly find other employment. You wouldn't just assume you were going to go into industry. So that's been proposed. And I think I would like to see something like that happen. I think we need a new strategy. That doesn't say we have to go everywhere in the world and fight every battle. I think we need a more defensive strategy, and we need to let allies in regions of concern do more in their own defense because they're closer to the scene. They can sort of assess the threats. You know, even now with Ukraine, a lot of European countries are not increasing their military spending because they have other priorities. So it's, you know, they've made a different assessment of that. I mean, countries bordering Russia have increased their spending, but the rest of Europe, for the large part, is holding steady. So, you know, I think the idea that we should be the not only the policeman, but the one who defines what security is for other countries, I think, you know, feeds a lot of this overspending. Then, of course, we should force the Pentagon to pass an audit, and I think they should withhold a certain amount of money to units that can't pass an audit. You know, so there's a whole range of things. I think there should be penalties for cost overruns instead of just letting the companies run rampant. And there should be sort of an independent assessment of what do we actually need. There's an independent assessment office in the Pentagon that looks at whether the weapons are performing well, but that doesn't have a lot of enforcement capability. But there's not really enough in the way of strategy coming from people who aren't making money from the military industrial complex, either in industry or career military. So
yeah, unbiased people, get people in there that don't have the money that have such an incentive for making money off of this.
That aren't going to earn more money if we're more warlike. Yeah.
Yeah. How about some rules around what can be considered confidential?
Yes, I think opening that up would make it a lot easier for people to understand that not all this money is being spent to defend us. And I think the clearer that becomes, the easier it would be to rein in the Pentagon's budget.
And we could probably be better, right? I mean, if we could have a stronger military and by just being smaller.
I think if, you know, if the military was smaller, better trained, we weren't trying to fight everywhere all the time, we cut out a lot of the waste, we built weapons that actually were for the purpose of the missions and not just for the purpose of feeding a, you know, this or that company, you could have a smaller, less expensive military that would be considerably more effective. And also, ideally, you would make better decisions about when military force makes any sense at all. And sometimes when you have a big military, it's like, well, here it is. I guess we should use it. And that's, you know, sort of a very backwards way to make your foreign policy.
Well, we could be more effective. We could be safer. And then we could be investing more in our own infrastructure and things that make us stronger at home as well, because we're going to be safer if our infrastructure and our manufacturing and all these other things are strong.
Exactly. In fact, that was another one of Eisenhower's points. You know, one of the reasons he didn't want to spend too much on the Pentagon was because he felt, you know, the ultimate base of our security was our economy. Having a strong economy, having
exactly
a healthy, well-educated population was the foundation of any kind of security that would be meaningful.
Well, this has been a really great conversation. And how can people get a copy of your book, Prophets of War? And is that do you have any new stuff coming out?
I've mostly been writing short pieces, you know, essays and such, which are available on our website, ciponline.org. And then my book, it's a couple years old now, so it's basically kind of an Amazon, or if you don't like Amazon, another online, purchasing option.
And you have articles I've noticed on Huffington Post, on New York Times. You're all over the place.
I try to put out as much as I can just because it's, the other side of the equation gets a lot of play, you know, so I think the more there's critical independent voices that people can find, the better off we're going to be.
Okay, that's great. And so once again, what is your website?
It's www.ciponline.org.
Okay, and we'll have that on the radio page as well with your, so they can find out more information about you and they can go from there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.